Thank you for attending 2020 Sunstone Digital Symposium Session 374, titled Mormonism, Purpose, and Afterlife, as seen through a purple rain. The audio from this session will be available for purchase at sunstone.org after the symposium. The video recording of this session will be available in the Hoova app for the remainder of 2020. We will be having a Q&A at the end of this session, so if you have any questions, please add them to the Hoova app, and they will be addressed during the Q&A. At Sunstone, we are making it a goal to build a community that allows many ways for people to express their faith. Our tagline is, there is more than one way to Mormon. We invite you to help us build a community where all paths are given space to be better understood. Please support us in our mission by making a donation and subscribing at sunstone.org. Much of what we believe depends on what we hope or fear. We judge others and our church through the lens of who we are, or the lens of who and where we are. In a particular moment, wonder becomes less a fascination than a question. While our questions of belief and believing are not inclined to be answered, increasingly we see only through a glass and darkly, which is why, for those such as us, old and foolish doubts of the present become less troublesome than regrets of the past, and we recognize in the uncertainty of the future something akin to faith. I'll now take a second to introduce our speaker before we begin. Clifton Jolly is a Mormon poet, critic, and essayist. His Voices column ran for 7 years in the Deseret News concurrent with his writing, The Spoken Word for the Tabernacle Choir. His obits appear regularly in the Salt Lake Tribune and elsewhere. I'll now give the floor to our presenter.
Thank you very much. So to give some of you the opportunity to escape, you need, I will confess that what I had intended to be more a philosophical speculation became a personal essay. And for that, I apologize, but writing take us where it wants to go frequently, more than where we would ourselves go. Mormonism, its purpose, and afterlife as seen through a purple rain. A few quotes at the beginning. Robert Browning said, "Grow old with me, the best is yet to be, the last of life for which the first was made." Clifford Odets wrote in his play, "Boy chick, wake up, be something, make your life something good. For the love of an old man who sees in your young days his new life, for such love, take the world in your two hands and make it like new. Go out and fight so life shouldn't be printed on dollar bills." And Prince, "I never meant to cause you any sorrow. I never meant to cause you any pain. I only wanted to see you laughing in the purple rain." When Prince died, my wife Abigail was forlorn, not because she had recently spent a lot of time listening to his music, but because of how good much of that music is, and because it now is at an end. One of the world's foremost influencers of popular music, whose talent had left a fortune somewhere north of $300 million, died alone in his home in the elevator. Those are words not likely to be found in the obituary of most of us. We don't have elevators in our homes, although I'm getting to the point I could use one. We aren't multimillionaires, and if we have lived well or been lucky, we won't die alone. But Abigail's grieving was less selfish than merely being a fan unhappy that there would be no new Prince albums, no more Prince concerts. She had not supplanted adoring Prince with grieving for him. For Abigail, the passing of Prince was a metaphor for things in life that may appear to be beyond repair, that may in fact be beyond repair. Ultimate events that rich and poor, famous and not, alike suffer alike. On the evening news recently, Lester Holt announced that millennials now outnumber baby boomers. He did not say why, but it's because baby boomers, people like me, are dying. Not in our elevators and hopefully not alone. But each of us of a certain age arrives at a realization that there is more of this life behind us than ahead, that the word eternal is a hopeful modification of words like life and glory. And unlike millennials, the sunny side of years in which boomers like us are now in shadow, we better recognize the difference between hoping and knowing, between what once gave us confidence and, if we are fortunate, now helps us face the ultimate, even though it does not help us recognize the point and purpose of our lives. And because of an increasing uncertainty of how much life we got right, what the poet calls age that brings the philosophic mind, many of us bear in us, and many of us bear it to the grave, a kind of ambivalence as to whether, on balance, the lives we've led have been good. Not merely worthy, but worthwhile. Whether the contributions we've made outweigh the damages we've done. And more profoundly, whether that is a sensible or even a moral way to think of life. Herbert Bradley, in his essay, Appearance and Reality, said that metaphysics is the finding of bad reasons for what we believe upon instinct. But to find these reasons is no less an instinct. Well, perhaps, but more so, this way of thinking of life as an accumulation of debits and credits is what one philosopher called life as accounting. And I think it's especially true of men of a certain age, such as myself. But the only evidence I have of this is that this is the way I think, because it's not the sort of thing men of any age normally talk about. And I can't be certain women are not similarly troubled, because, well, women primarily talk to one another. I'm 75, and although I suspect I care about the same sorts of things most men my age care about, it could well be most men go to bed most nights and wake up most mornings feeling just peachy keen with the way their lives have turned out, happily anticipating the reward stored up for them in the next innings of the Mormon eternity game. Certain their accountancy has more in the credits column than in the debits. I don't. And as confident as I am of the life that follows this life, I find myself increasingly troubled by the life behind me in a way for which the life ahead of me does not compensate nor ameliorate. This is not specifically regret, although that's part of it, guilt too, and a sense of having been wrong about many things of which I still am uncertain how to be right. It's a gestalt of all these things bound by a nameless ennui that even if I could fix all the other, still would be unfixable. Curiously, it's this confusion that emerges as the greater encouragement of my faith and the increasing abundance of my hope. As the purpose I once felt so specific is generalized by wonder, as what I learn ever more threatens what I once knew. In other words, the wisdom I believed would compensate my age for the loss of youth and beauty and strength is yet another disappointment, a disappointment that inspires anticipation more than apprehension. they say that it is the fear of death and of what comes after death that makes men turn to religion as they advance in years. But my own experience has given me the conviction that quite apart from any such terrors or imaginings, the religious sentiment tends to develop as we grow older. And these, by the way, are not my words. They're the words of Aldous Huxley in Brave New World. He continues, they develop because as the passions grow calm, as the fancy and sensibilities are less excited and less excitable, our reason becomes less troubled in its working, less obscured by the images, desires, and distractions in which it used to be absorbed. Whereupon, God emerges as from behind a cloud. Our soul feels, sees, turns towards the source of all light, turns naturally and inevitably. For now that all that gave to the world of sensations its life and charms has begun to leak away from us, now that phenomenal existence is no more bolstered up by impressions from within or from without, yes, we inevitably turn to God. For this religious sentiment is of its nature so pure, so delightful to the soul, that it experiences it, that it makes up to us for all of our other losses. T.S. Eliot called this the end of our beginning, and he said that to experience it is to arrive where we started and to know the place for the first time. But for some of us, it is more to realize that our end is very far removed from our beginning. And what we have come to know is very much the havoc we wreaked along the way. The paradox of age that brings not wisdom or a mind so philosophic as curiously concerned, that may cause us to agree more with Edwin Arlington Robinson, who wrote of one Mr. Flood and a not very happy party he had by himself. There was not much that was ahead of him, and there was nothing in the town below where strangers would have shut the many doors that many friends had opened long ago. In short, whatever the acquisitions of fortune or faith or fame, the most some of us may hope is simply not to die alone, which is a hope frustrated by having lived long, since many of us have more friends at the beginning than at the end. Partly this is because of death, and partly it's because friends, like family, are easy before the people we know have an opportunity to know and have an opinion about us. And our opinions about ourselves are so frequently at odds with the opinions of those that we know and love, one is sometimes left to wonder how any relationships survive, especially when we can never know another's heart truly, another's trouble, another's joy. The envelope of flesh we walk around in is simply a poor conductor of detail, more refined than to know whether or not we should put on a sweater. And our ability to speak and to hear, much less to listen, is better suited to shopping lists than to communion with another. Even when we attempt to share our thoughts and feelings, they are filtered by systems as rough and rangy as the wordless testaments of our flesh. We speak, we smile, we frown, we touch another's hand. We tell what we feel safe to tell or what we have courage ourselves to consider. But some of our truths are so terrible or so strange we are unable to speak them even to ourselves, to see them even with our own eyes, much less to reveal them to the sight, hearing, and keeping of another. Poets write and clergy make pronouncements about mystical unions, the romantic and the sacred. But they generally do so without consideration of the real secrets we keep, the unshareable fears, the uncomforted pains, the isolation that keeps us as surely from one another as though it were a cowl over the third eye, blinding us and others to the dread each of us inhabits. The author and poet James Dickey once said in his book, Deliverance, that said of his book Deliverance that it is a story about our more primitive, about the most primitive of our fears, and that is the apprehension of being set upon by strangers. But strangers are often the ones to whom we unbridle ourselves, therapists, bishops, people met on trains, while those to whom we are romantically or sacredly entwined least know what we do not ourselves know or are afraid to say. It has become popular in defending those who have done truly terrible things to allow that no one is one thing or another she is or has done, however terrible or noble the act, however brave or depraved the behavior. But it's also true that we may be more made and revealed by what we do than what we think or believe. While no one of those single acts or thoughts is singly who we are completely, the extreme can be a profound and telling evidence of the mean. Again, in Brave New World, the protagonist's discovery of himself is not only a revelation, but a damning one. When Winston pleads that the horror of his torture should not come to himself, but to his lover, Julia, he speaks to the irrationality that unrecognized, unconfronted, misunderstood, threatens to reduce any of us to the least of who we are. The cowardice of Huxley's protagonist is not a definition, but a warning. Each of us, sequestered, alone with our secret trouble, may be reduced to monstrosity in the moment. And although that does not mean we are reducible, that we are monsters, it does speak to our need for one another, and more specifically, for another who will help us to be, perhaps even to become. The Kabbalah speaks of beshert, a belief that each of us were truly one with another in a spiritual preexistence, male and female in a single infinite creature. But before sending us to earth to discover the terribles of mortality, God divided us into male and female and sent us lonely into the world. Part of the ambitious, most intended for this life, the Kabbalah suggests, is to discover our completing other and to make such a one as whole as we are made by the balancing of our frailty with their strength, our fear with their courage, our insensitivity with their empathy. To frustrate such completion is to deny the intention of the divine, but more terrifying in the moment of such solitude, it sends us lonely into Huxley's Inquisition, where we become the victims of our isolation rather than the refugees from our fear. And I think the fulfillment of Mormonism, of that Kabbalah myth, is that we extend this union into the life that follows this. Well, even if the Kabbalah parable were fact, each of us have dark moments of the soul in which neither the light of another nor the truth of the divine can brighten the ultimate gloom of our despair. As the folk philosopher Margaret Masters once advised, each of us is in pain. So the most any of us can do is be kind. One of the threats to our capacity to kindness, however, is to separate us, isolate us, prohibit us from the strength, integrity, joy, and sensitivity of another, to shackle us alone in the darkness, and by that moment persuade us that we are truly alone. I think that's one of the reasons Jean England wrote that the church is as true as the gospel, because it is in church that we are not alone. It is in church that we have faith one with another. It is in church that we are sinners and believers together as one. But it is in moments of despair, it's in moments of isolation, that both heroes are made and cowardice is revealed. The mob seeks authority and numbers from the individual fear that only in the superiority of numbers is there safety. While good soldiers are taught that fear never will be conquered by a warrior, but only managed. Not fearlessness, but discipline or muscle memory makes the hero. And that's why Marines are taught that they do not fight for country, they do not fight for flag, they fight for one another. In the short happy life of Francis McCumber, the White Hunter advises, it does no good to talk about such things, when Francis tries to explain to him how he feels, finally at one with his own courage. It does no good to talk about such things, the White Hunter says, and so most men don't. But what is there to do if, like Hemingway says, we do not talk? Since there is no hope of adjusting the trajectory of so many things we did or didn't do so long ago. And perhaps had Hemingway talked more about the things men shouldn't talk about, he wouldn't have put a gun in his mouth. Now, hopefully you're thinking, what is this sad sack talking about? I've done a world of good, and the world is a good place. And if so, I'm glad of what you can see more clearly than I can. Not all of us have such a blessing when we are more towards the end than the beginning. I comfort myself in the belief that the bad we do probably is not much more important than the good we do, in the eternal sense. And I'm compelled to hope in that eternal, even if there is slim evidence of it in this life. Immanuel Kant gave 10 reasons to believe in an afterlife, and one of them was that since doing good in this life is not always rewarded in this life, and good is a virtue that must be rewarded to justify the utility of moral living, there must be a life beyond this in which our unrewarded good will be compensated. Well, the problem with that argument is that people like me think of it in the reverse. Since I got away with so much in this life, there must be life beyond this in which I'll be found out. And in point of fact, one Mormon apostle said very much that same thing, that the last judgment is not a place at which our good is balanced against our evil. It's a place where we simply are found out. We stand before God, stripped of all the accoutrements of our vanity, simply ourselves. When I was younger, one of the last of the polio generation, and the last of my generation prior to Salk that caught polio, I thought heaven would be a place in which everyone would know the pain I was in and have pity. Because one of the accoutrements of polio is post-polio, which makes one try to remember whether polio was in fact as bad. What I now fear is that everyone will know the pain I was in and think, well, that's not so much. I've had worse. It wasn't bone surgery or lung cancer. It wasn't even severe arthritis. What was all the whining about? This guy had so much pity for himself that he neglected to pity others. Regardless of the risks, I cling to the confidence that there is sight that begins subsequent to this world of frequent blindness. Not so much because I see any great value in a consciousness such as mine surviving. When my belief is challenged by those of my children who do not believe, I tell them that either the afterlife will be as I have believed it to be, or it will be like my last colonoscopy, blissful oblivion, a sleep from which I never again need to awake. In fact, either sounds pretty good to me, although I believe in the previous, the prior, the first. And if I do come to the other side of that last great colonoscopy to discover that there is a conscious me that continues, it will be to rediscover the consciousness I met and failed along the way, that I may perhaps be permitted to take things up again in a fairer place where I can be wiser and braver and better, where I can regard myself less and hurt others less and be less a whiner, where I can do the good I imagined myself to do when I was too young to do much of anything but harm. And that will be my heaven. And if not, well, there's always Hemingway. For those of us who think and doubt and refuse the evidence of both hope and regret, there is trouble at the end, as Nathaniel Hawthorne had young Goodman Brown discover because of what was likely no more than a dream, the uncertainty of life and the suspicion of abandon convicted him. As Hawthorne writes, "And when he had lived long and was borne to his grave, a hoary corpse, followed by Faith, his wife, an aged woman, and children and grandchildren, and a goodly procession besides neighbors, not a few, they carved no hopeful verse upon his tombstone, for his dying hour was gloom." Even Faith could not sustain him against doubt. For young Goodman Brown, the haze is not so much purple as profound, without abatement, without relief. I think many of us wander in that haze, the details of our lives made indistinct by what we have learned, what we hope, less helpful because of what we know, regardless our anticipation or despair in what is beyond this life. We become suspicious that the first of life was not only less than we presumed it to be, but that the end of life will be less still. So good for you if you know the good you've done and if those you love recognize it. You've arrived where we all believed that we would go. As for the disappointment and the regret of those of us not so blessed, We who are inclined to hope your life is more a happy accident than evidence of a superior soul, or better still, ignorance of your true predicament, or best of all, that you are just plain lying about it. For us, there is the hope of Browning and Odette's and the scriptures. And there is counting the ways we have loved and that we have failed to love, lived and failed life, been and refused the best evidences of purposes in being. And of course, there is terriers barking. And here's the beginning of my counting. If I'm to be an accountant at the end, here's the beginning of my wishing, my plan for the next being. I wish that I'd been more, done more, helped more, loved more, been more patient, been better prepared just to wait, suffered less, wanted less, shouted less, fought not at all, planned better, been better, lived better, if less well, been a better husband, a better father, a better son, remembered more to pray and figured out why we do, been faithful longer and faithless sooner, known that the end of faith is not the end of believing, that the end of religion is not the end of faith, that concern and compassion matter more than ambition, that money matters, but is simple, that the simple things in life are not always the most important, that complexity is inevitable for those of us less lucky, that lucky is not the same as blessed, that sometimes the question is sufficient, and sometimes the answer needs only to be a better question. I wish that I'd eaten more prunes and less needed to eat them, discovered sooner that driving is not a competition, more suspected more causes and found more causes less deserving suspicion, realized that a true church is less important, perhaps, than being a true person, realized that true people are not enough to make a true church, understood that truth is not the only importance of going to church, spent less time searching for God and invested more time trying to be godly, known that whether or not Elijah comes to the door of the Seder, we will go to be with Elijah, anticipated the vision of a Savior in everything, and denied the proposition that everything is our Savior. Understood that being better has more to do with others. Found a way, a better way, to make whole wheat waffles perfect every single time. Made peace with knowing that people are like imperfect whole wheat waffles, and that inside every burnt waffle, there's still a lot of good waffle. That's why I wish for myself so many things. And by so doing, again, defeat the true opportunity of life to be so transformed by love that I forget myself in the lives of those I love, that by becoming an example of love, I reveal to loved ones that, ruined as I am, there is more. As Rabbi Zusha discovered only as he lay dying. When his students gathered around the rabbi, hoping to hear him teach a last lesson, he said, "In the coming world, God will not ask me, 'Why were you not as Moses?' Because I am not Moses. God will not ask me, 'Why are you not as Isaiah?' Because I am not Isaiah. The students then asked Rabbi Zusha, "Why then do you weep?" He sighed as he answered, "Because God will ask me, why were you not Zusha? And what shall I answer then?" We each have the life we make, and in it we are either true to what God intended or not. And in the end, God may be more interested in what we intend. Because although we focus on what is done or not done, the accounting and accountancy of our living, the greater tragedy than the evil we do and the good we do not is the person we become or fail to become. And perhaps what God most intends, in addition to our loving and being loved, our doubt, our regret, our faith, our hope, is just life itself. Again, in Brave New World, the Inquisitor says to the old man, speaking of the manufactured, painless world that they have made, this brave new world, a world free of age and aging, kept free from sin by strict discipline from the experiences of life itself. He says that once every month, they fill the world with energy, with endorphins. He says it's the complete physiological equivalent of fear and rage, things prohibited now in the world. All the tonic effects of murdering Desdemona and being murdered by Othello, but without any of the inconveniences. And the old man, who, by the way, in the book is called the Savage, he says, "But I like the inconveniences." "Well, we don't," said the Inquisitor. "We prefer to do things comfortably." And the old man answers, "But I don't want comfort. I want God. I want poetry. I want real danger. I want freedom. I want goodness. Even I want sin." "In fact," the Inquisitor says, "you're claiming the right to be unhappy." "All right, then," said the Savage defiantly. "I'm claiming the right to be unhappy. Not to mention the right to grow old and ugly and impotent, the right to have syphilis and cancer, the right to have too little to eat, the right to be lousy, the right to live in constant apprehension of what may happen tomorrow, the right to catch typhoid, the right to be tortured by unspeakable pains of every kind, the right to have polio and post-polio." Okay, I added that in myself. In Clifford Odette's play, Paradise Lost, although a family loses almost everything else during the last days of the Great Depression, they do not lose sight of what they presume is possible in this world or the next, paradise, if only we can see it. Left standing alone in an empty room that once was crowded with furniture that they have been selling just to stay alive, in the last scene, and quite by accident, they discover a small stash of money in a vase not yet carried off by creditors. After imagining ways in which they can use the money to satisfy their own immediate needs, they decide instead to give it to someone even more needy than themselves. So they call in from the street a derelict and give him the last of their wealth. The poor man looks around the empty room, considers the plight of his benefactor, and then instead of thanking, he accuses them. He says, "Pardon my dust." And he repeats it again and again, chastising them for presuming to be superior to him, better than him, for finding him so desperate as to need their charity. And then he leaves, with the money, of course. The only moments in theater I've found equally desperate are the final moments of King Lear, Romeo and Juliet, and Death of a Salesman. But unlike those more traditional tragedies, the Odette's protagonist of the production crosses the proscenium arch, steps to the apron of the stage, violates the fourth wall of theater, and speaks directly to the audience, denying every evidence of the play that has preceded, every disappointment of every scene. And he says, "No, there's more to life than this. That was the past, but there is a future. Now we know, we dare to understand truly. Truly, the past was a dream, but this is real. To know from this that something must be done that is real. We searched, we were confused, but we searched. And now the search is ended, for the truth has found us. For the first time in our lives, for the first time, our house has a real foundation. I tell you, the whole world is for us to possess. Heartbreak and terror are not our heritage. The world is beautiful. No fruit tree wears a lock and key. People will sing at their work. People will love. Oh, darling, the world is in its mourning, and no man fights alone. Let's have air. Open the windows," he says. That is my confidence, my hope, that death is not the grave, nor are we intended to despair at the appearance of the terrible moment, or be disappointed by the hopelessness of a cause, the failures of a faith, the fruitlessness of dreams, the lack of evidence of an ultimate event. We are more than this. All of us are more. And if not, well, there is always Hemingway. And of course, there's colonoscopy. Thank you very much. I think Glenn is still with us, but may not have turned on his microphone. Or he may have been drummed into silence by the length and tediousness of the presentation. I suspect what I can do is go, because it's not available to me on this screen, but I think that I can go to the application and I can find questions, if there are any. No. I can give questions. And perhaps, let's see, I should have tried to figure this before the moment. There are 11 of you. One of you actually said you liked the presentation. And no, that is from me. I don't see any questions. Glenn has taken a necessary and appropriate vacation from all of this. If you have questions, I think you can enter them, and I might actually be able to see some of them.
I can ask them for you.
Oh, there you are, Glenn.
Sorry, my mic was turning back on. the first question that we have is, what leads you to have such a cheerful disposition? What kind of a God do you believe in?
Well, first of all, my wife is Jewish, and that settles one. And I am a convert to Judaism who believes himself still to be a Mormon. And perhaps much of the trouble I have is that complication. One of my rabbis once asked, I told my rabbi, in Reform Judaism, the most frequent answer is, who knows? And I told the rabbi, I said, I come from a religion and tradition in which a lot of stuff is known. And what isn't known, we pretend to know. And so this is an unusual and an uncomfortable position for me to find myself in, this ambiguity. And he said, well, what do you do about that? And I said, well, it's very simple. I said, wherever I come to something in Judaism for which there's no answer, I just fill in with my Mormonism. And he laughed and he said, ha, that's really funny, Cliff. Promise that you won't bring it up at temple. And I haven't. The God I believe in is the God that I was raised with, the Mormon God. Judaism, more liberal than Mormonism, does not prohibit me from believing in this God happily. But the older I've become, the less I've come to believe that I understand this God. I believe that I was healed from polio by a priesthood blessing. My family believes that. I have 11 brothers and sisters. They all, if you ask them for an evidence of a miracle, they'd say, well, Clifton was told by every doctor he'd never walk again, but he had a Mormon blessing mom and dad believed in, and look at him. He doesn't walk very well, but he walks. But a person who is naturally given to questions, I'm given to asking myself, I grew up reading about all these people had polio and then went on to win a gold medal in the Olympics. And I know it's petty and it's wrong, but when God was healing me from polio, how much trouble additionally would it have been to make my legs match? One of my legs is badly atrophied. And these kinds of questions compound themselves the older one becomes, and the more one becomes concerned that the answers that I satisfied myself with when I was younger were maybe personal satisfactions. And I should have been more troubled by the kinds of troubling questions that some of my very close friends were troubled by. And I suspect increasingly troubled with as I grow older, but I believe, and I believe that when I die, I will reach my hand through that veil and it will be taken by my mother and my father who will bring me home. That's the God I believe in.
This next question is, would you rather be lucky or blessed?
My father, both of my fathers, my father, who was a Mormon bishop, died when he was 42 of a heart attack. And I was sufficiently unlucky that my mother sometimes later married another bishop. And Dad Stone, once asked me this question a little differently. He said, would you rather be lucky or smart? Well, he was brilliant. I knew I would never be as smart as he was. So I said, lucky. And he smiled and he said, for you, that's a very smart answer. And so in that instance, I'd rather be lucky. But the luck of this world is unreliable. as are blessings, by the way. Not all prayers are answered. Not all infirmity is healed. Not all bodies are made perfect. And so my trust is in God's blessing wherever I find it. And my children say, you think everything's a blessing. Every good thing's a blessing. And I know it's not, but I don't want to miss thanking God for something that truly is. I'd rather be blessed. Thank you.
The next one is, so are you a romantic after all?
Romanticism is cursed by sentimentality. My friend Bob Rees, Bob's a romantic. I mean, all you need to do is listen to Bob for a while. He is a romantic. He believes deeply. I think he knows I believe deeply too, although on many things we believe deeply differently. After a session this morning, we spent an hour arguing, at the end of which always tells me I'm wrong and hangs up. I am not a romantic. The woman I quoted, Margaret Masters, her actual name was Maggie Smith. She was one of Salt Lake City's first television personalities. And when I was writing for the Deseret News, I got a call from her one day, and she said that she wanted to learn to write and I was going to teach her. And I told her I didn't do that sort of thing. And she said, put the phone down, son, and go ask somebody who I am. And I asked Winifred Jardine, who had been at the paper forever. And she said, Maggie Smith, my word, she's great. I have a chance to meet her too. And so I did. And every Wednesday I spent with Maggie and learned from her much of the good that I know. And Maggie was once accused of being a romantic by one of her son-in-laws. And she was very angry about it. She says, I'm not a romantic. She said, I was a midwife when I was young and I buried as many people as I birthed. It's just that I see things more clearly than everyone else. I would like to be that kind of romantic. And I think there are relatively few of them. I think romantics by and large have a tendency to dismiss the suffering of others, and I wouldn't want to be that kind of romantic.
Next question. What kind of brave new world would you design?
Well, I like the world we've got. For the same world that the savage did. I guess that's what I am, a kind of savage. I was raised in a very civilized environment by a Mormon Relief Society president mother and two bishops and I became savage along the way, I think. But the world that I want is the world we have because it's the world that God has given it to us. I don't always understand it. I don't understand what he was thinking or she, depending upon who was more responsible for putting it all together. So this is the world that I want. I'd like to learn before I die, how to live in it a little better, but I think that's unlikely. I think that what I have yet to learn, I'll probably learn on the other side. This is the world I want. It's the world in which my wife is, my children are, my grandchildren, my two churches. This is the world.
That is the last of the questions that have come in. If anybody else has a question, you can ask it on through the Whova application on your phone. Otherwise, it's up to you how long you'd like to wait for another question to come in.
I have No need to wait. Mark Twain said, it's a terrible death to be talked to death. Let us spare them that death.
Okay. All right. Well, Clifton, thank you for coming, and thank you everyone for attending and supporting Sunstone.
Thank you.